I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guests today are David Toggiano and TJ Provenzano, who are the co-owners of Mayanoki, a charming 8-seat Japanese sushi restaurant in Alphabet City in New York, which opened in May 2017. And also joined is the Mayanoki's executive chef, Jeff Miller. The highly recognized Mayanoki is unique in many ways, in particular for its strong focus on sustainability. Sushi is becoming increasingly popular because it's just tasty and also for its healthy nature, but preservation of fish is a serious issue nowadays. So today we'll discuss how Mayanoki serves great sushi and tries to preserve ocean resources at the same time, and how the passionate young American entrepreneurs decided to open a sushi restaurant, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We appreciate your feedback. Let's start a conversation with the Mayanoki team. So, David, TJ, Jeff, welcome to Japan Eats.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks.
All right. So, first, let's talk about you guys' background. So, where did you grow up and what was your life before opening Mayanoki? So, maybe, you know, start with David?
Sure. I grew up out on Long Island in New York before Mayanoki. I still work in technology as a day job, so that was my life before Mayanoki. Before starting Mayanoki, I just ate sushi, and now I help to serve it or prepare it for people. I grew up near the water, and I think that may have provided some interest in seafood, and coming from an immigrant background, we always had fresh food around, so I think that was also a driver of like being interested in the restaurant industry.
And I also heard that you were as a part-time job, like when you were much younger, you were on the boat and you were almost struck by lightning within 500 yards of fishing boat. And yeah. I heard that changed your perception of sushi.
Well, it was a charter fishing boat, so we would take groups of people out to kind of recreational fish. And there was one particular storm that we didn't get into the port fast enough. But I think just in general, being out there, you kind of just see how amazing Mother Nature can be. Mm. So that's kind of how it changed my perspective.
Right. Okay. What about you, TJ?
I am from Westchester, New York, originally. I've been working in restaurants in New York City for the last over a decade or so.
Oh, by the way, listeners, TJ is the beverage director of Mayanoki.
Yes, indeed. I like to drink. Sure. I grew up in Westchester. My father owned a bagel store in Westchester, so I grew up around the food business. And in college, I got my first wine buying job at an Italian restaurant and kind of never looked back.
Wow. Okay. Jeff?
Hey. I grew up in Grass Valley, California, in the Sierra foothills. I started making sushi while I was going to school at the University of Florida.
But how did it happen, though? You cannot just start making sushi.
Yeah, no, you're right. A few days after I moved to Gainesville, which is where the university is, I walked into what I had heard was the best sushi restaurant there. I needed a job, and I thought it would be... I love to eat sushi. I had wanted to learn to make sushi for a while. I thought it would be a fun way to pay the bills. And I walked in, and I had no business getting a job there, but the chef who was working that day, he was expecting a friend of the owner to be coming in looking for a job, and so he thought that I was that friend, and he thought that he had to hire me.
What happened to the other guy?
That's a good question. I don't know.
But, never showed up.
Yeah, so I walked in, and I had printed out 20 resumes that day. I was going to go all over town. I had... And I didn't need a single one, because I walked in and met the chef. His name is Tun. And he just gave me the paperwork. Wow. I thought, man, Gainesville really must need workers. He didn't tell me that story for about 2 years. I didn't know it. But anyway, that's how I got the job there.
Wow.
I worked my way up in that restaurant for 5 years. It's called Dragonfly. And then I spent 5 years with another company in Texas. And then I came up here in November.
So before you got that job, you used to eat a lot of sushi and you knew how to make sushi?
Yeah. I ate a lot of sushi in California. And I tried making it at home a few times. And so that gave me, like, having made it at home 3 or 4 times... really just avocado rolls. Mm. That gave me what I thought was enough confidence to walk into a restaurant and ask for a job. I think if I had known how much I didn't know and how much work was ahead of me at that time, I wouldn't have considered it. But I was so dumb, I had no idea.
Yeah, that's the power of youth, right?
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, it's a lesson, right? We can just maybe... forget about everything, how much you don't know, and then start doing it.
Oh, exactly. Just bit by bit. So, yeah, that was 11 years ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So that's interesting because I think nowadays a lot of people wants to study sushi and there are schools, but it sounds like you learned in a very traditional way at the restaurant.
I learned, to me, what's becoming an American traditional way. It's not I didn't learn in the traditional Japanese way of being a like one chef's apprentice. I worked in larger, higher volume restaurants, which is, I mean, that's the majority of sushi in this country. Started out with lots of rolls and then slowly got more into the craft and more into the history of it. And over time, yeah, it does become an obsession, but yeah, that's...
Hey, so you came a long way. Your sushi looks very beautiful, so amazing.
Thank you. Have you seen it?
Yeah, in pictures. I haven't been to your restaurant yet. So, okay, but how did you guys meet each other? Including Josh, who is another owner. Maybe, David, you can talk about Josh,
sure.
Who's not here today. But,
yes.
Yeah, the co-owner.
Josh Arik is another of the partners. He and I go back to college. We were friends from our college days and just remained friends. We also ate a lot of sushi, I think, like all of us. And that's how we became friends initially with a chef who we were starting the pop-up when we first started. And I think actually Josh found TJ and called TJ on the phone and said, hey, we want to serve some sushi. Are you interested? And
for sure. Yeah, I was at Brooklyn Oenology. I was running that winery that was in Williamsburg for a long time. And we used to do all kinds of events, all kinds of, you know, chef pop-ups and that kind of thing. And Dave and Josh reached out to me to, you know, start doing these Mayanoki pop-ups at the winery. And became fast friends and just, you know, kept doing it for, I think, 5 years we were doing it for.
Yeah.
And just kept the steam rolling, kept the ball rolling. And here we are today.
Right. And then where's Jeff in the picture?
You tell that part. So we, as we were kind of experimenting and learning about serving sushi and becoming sustainable, we kind of always plotted, like, what's our next kind of step, because we were operating out of BOE for so long. We wanted to find a place that was at least a month-long pop-up. And then we ended up taking over a restaurant on Clinton Street, and the chef there actually put us in touch with Jeff, who I think had heard of my gnocchi before we kind of connected.
Yeah, it's I got into the sustainable side of sushi when I started ordering fish for the company I was working for in Texas.
That's Uchi, right?
Yeah.
Uchi and Uchiko,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Once you get into sustainable sushi, which really just means you're not ordering fish that are going extinct or that are polluting the waters. Anyway, we'll save that. once you get into that world, it's a pretty small world, sustainable sushi in this country. So I had read about a couple of restaurants on the West Coast, like Bamboo in Portland, and I'd read about this pop-up that was happening off and on in New York.
Right, but in the first place, though, I think a question to David, but why did you decide to open a sustainable sushi restaurant? It's a big commitment, and you started pop-up at your home, right?
Yeah, basically. So as I mentioned, Josh and I were going to a restaurant in Tribeca for a few years and became really good friends with the chef. When that place closed down, we had an idea of trying to get the chef into his own restaurant, and that's kind of how the pop-up started. So we originally just started asking him to come to our apartments and serving, you know, small amounts of people, 4, 6, 8 people, friends and family. And we figured that if we can get 7, 8, 10 people in our apartment, can we get 10 people outside of our apartment to show up for sushi? We didn't start with the intention of being sustainable. We probably operated for like 6 or 8 months, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe not that long. Let's say 6 months before we realized, when we were buying the fish and learning about it, we were just realizing how much of an environmental impact farmed salmon in particular had, because that was the one that I personally loved at the time. And then just realizing that the way that when you look at the fish, you see these large, you know, stripes of fat in it. It's because the fish can't swim in the pens, and they're full of antibiotics and chemicals to keep them alive, basically. And we just realized that this doesn't align with our principles. So if we're not willing to eat the fish, we're not going to serve it to people. And then slowly we just started figuring out, we didn't know if it was possible to be a sustainable sushi restaurant because we hadn't known many people that were doing it or anybody personally that was doing it. So we just slowly kind of experimented with what we can serve and, you know, what are better options, and doing a lot of research.
Okay. So yeah, I'm going to get into that details shortly, but let's just talk quickly about the pop-ups. So pop-ups uses friends and family and expanded to Brooklyn Analogy. And who came to those events?
I don't know. Who did come? Well, I think in the beginning, like the first night that we held our event, it was still a lot of friends and family. I think we had 20 people that first night.
It was a larger one, yeah.
Completely different format. We had like family style platter, kind of sushi, a lot of sashimi actually, not even sushi. And honestly, it's always from the beginning, it's kind of been word of mouth. We started building up an email list of people. We were doing some promotional stuff, working with some, you know, third party vendors for advertising on, you know, dating sites, or like, you know, what to do in for your birthday or stuff like that. But we just kept adding people to our newsletter, and we were able to kind of always fill the seats. I think it was partly because we were only operating once a month, 2 days out of the month. And there was only 18 or 16 or 20 seats available. So people would try to purchase, and then it would be sold out within, let's say an hour or two.
Wow.
So people were always kind of on the lookout for the next event. But very quickly, I mean, it was really just stranger. I mean, it wasn't anybody that we knew personally that was showing up. It was just people that were interested in, I think, you know, pop-ups in general, something that's a little more exclusive. And then sushi, you know, everybody kind of loves sushi. So putting those two things together, I think, intrigued a lot of people.
Right.
And then having the guests at Brooklyn Analogy kind of see the space transformed into a sushi restaurant once a month. I was really excited for them. So they constantly were like, what's going on over there? And they wanted to get involved. So it just kind of kept growing in that way. And the wait list kept growing. And now we have our own brick and mortar restaurant after all these years.
Right. That's a very sustainable way to grow business.
Organic
too.
Growth. Yeah,
right.
Sure.
Right. So let's talk about the Mayonoki. So what's the meaning of Mayonoki?
That's a great question.
Josh and I kind of made it up. It doesn't really have any meaning. I mean, the kind of approach that we take to it now is there was really no roadmap for us to follow, so we just kind of had to figure out what Mayonoki was, and we were watching a movie and we literally just put two words together and during the credits, and that's kind of the backstory.
Okay.
So it's a name. But we have been told by our Japanese guests that if you break it down, and you obviously correct me if I'm wrong, but Maya means in front of, and Noki means tree, so in front of the tree we'll go with. And we do have a garden right next door, one of those community gardens next to the restaurant.
Right.
So we'll go with that.
Cool. Yeah, actually I looked up, and then there's the bread nut. It's like a Maya tree, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I thought it was some mysterious reason, but I like that. Okay, so, by the way, sushi is very traditional, traditional-oriented genre by Japanese cuisine. So what do you feel about being American, you know, owning and wanting cooking sushi?
I mean, I'll let these guys answer as well, but for me personally, I think it's... making it American. You know, we're taking actually the concept that's very Japanese of seeing something and then adopting it and kind of making it your own. And I think it's just time where we don't need to replicate the sushi that's going on in Japan in the U.S. We can make American sushi in the U.S. and use local ingredients and still honor and respect the tradition, but there's no reason to be flying in fish from halfway around the world when we have great seafood here.
He said he was going to let me answer, and then he took my answer.
Sorry.
So now I don't have much to say other than I agree with him wholeheartedly.
Well, no, but I mean, so I think the one thing for me, I'm biased as well, but like going to other sushi restaurants, Jeff's food is, I mean, you taste Texas in it. Like their flavor profiles, like the tomatillo salsa, like there are elements that are uniquely American, not just from the fish, but from all the other ingredients that I think really, you know, takes that principle to heart. And you're getting flavor profiles that are American sushi that I've never had in any other sushi omakase in the city. So
yeah.
Plus New York wine.
So I think, we all have so it's impossible not to respect the Japanese tradition when it comes to everything Japanese, but sushi is what we're talking about. And for me and I think for us the best way to show that respect is not to try to recreate the authentic Japanese experience, because none of us is Japanese. It's to learn as much about it, understand the tradition, and then adapt it to where we are and what we have available. And for me, if I were to try to use exclusively Japanese fish and describe them in Japanese terms, it would feel like I was putting on a show. I'm trying to create something more genuine and authentic for myself.
Right, that's exciting.
Yeah,
absolutely.
There's something kind of inherently rebellious about being a sustainable sushi restaurant, kind of going against the grain and standing out from other places. And, you know, I think these guys said it best, not trying to be something that we're not. We're trying to be ourselves. We are New Yorkers. We're a New York sushi restaurant focusing with, you know, on local wines, local species, and really not trying to be something else.
Right, that's exciting. I think it's the reminds of me of, you know, Japanese sushi used to be by nature sustainable because only local fish.
Yeah.
But I think nowadays it's impossible to globalize the economy. And also, I think it's very exciting that, you know, Japanese people really know for taking other cultures something and make it their own thing. So like, you know, yakiniku from Korea, tempura from Portugal, that kind of thing. So
even the earliest, the absolute origins of sushi aren't rooted in Japan. Started out as a Korean fish preservation method and then moved right. up. So yeah, it's just I the idea of tradition gets stuck in people's heads, but it's it's always evolving.
Right. And also,
I want to be a part of that evolution. We want to be a part of evolving it into this country even further.
Right. Even the California rolls and Dragon rolls, it's really a progress to me.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people turn their noses up at it, but it's as long as it's well made, it's just its own genre. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to constantly be compared with Edomai sushi.
Yeah, and I think those roles, creative roles, democratized sushi to a lot of people, right? So I think they should get a huge credit in the world of sushi.
Yeah, I spent years making rolls. I can't speak poorly of them at all. A lot of cream cheese in my background.
Wow.
Not a spicy mayo.
Yeah, but this is, you know, just because it's not familiar, it doesn't make sense, right? There's umami in it. This combination really is tasty. So, yeah, I'm pretty open to those things. So, what's the concept of a mayonoki?
Yeah, I think that's kind of what we were just saying. You know, taking the principles, but applying our own take on it. So whether it's using only American ingredients or serving only local wines, and really just making people comfortable, right?
I mean, yeah, I think in our space in particular, having 8 seats, you know, we're able to connect with guests a little bit easier than other restaurants may. Jeff and my wife Brianna, who runs the front of the house, are able to get a lot of this information across to guests that are curious, that sometimes don't have a comprehensive understanding about where these species are coming from and how they are being overfished, and you know how traditional seafood restaurants are not supporting, you know, protective environmental habits. So us being able to relay that information to the guest, I think, is just as important for our experience as, you know, the food itself.
And I think, you know, Jeff is very willing to kind of talk with folks, and Brianna as well. I think it's a little disarming because sometimes I think you go into a sushi restaurant and people are very intimidated. they feel like they can't ask questions or have a conversation. And, you know, when we go in, we're always having a conversation with the chef, and we know that they want to have a conversation, but it's always hard to kind of break that ice initially. And I think for us, it's just, even if people come in not thinking or caring about sustainability, even if we just put one thought in their mind of thinking of what to order next time, I think that's would be a goal, you know, just so that they even think about it the next time that they're in another restaurant.
Right. So that 8-seat sitting is pretty typical, I think, in Japan. So because of the communication, and everybody has like your favorite coffee shop the same way you have favorite sushi place. So.
Definitely.
Right. Yeah. So where do you source sustainable fish from?
We use 4 or 5 companies, and some of these companies are just one man operations, but so at the top of our list of priorities when we're sourcing fishes is sustainability, and from there, as locally as we can source. So for that, we depend pretty heavily on Greenpoint Fish and Lobster, which is a local seafood company, and they specialize in sustainable seafood. And it's a smaller company, so for us, it's great because to do what we do requires a lot of communication, a lot of conversations about everything that we're bringing in. And even though we're a tiny restaurant, they're willing to take the time to do that with us. So that's the biggest one. And then we have, we work with a couple national distributors. And then, like I said before, small companies, as small as one in Newburgh, New York, called Eco Shrimp Garden. Run by this wonderful Brazilian gentleman named Jean-Claude, who's all he's doing is farming one species of shrimp in the basement of what used to be a mattress factory up there. Inland recirculating tanks is sustainable as an operation can be, and the shrimp are outstanding. So that's, I guess, kind of a quick overview, but it's really easy, actually, to source sustainably.
Wow, really?
And it wasn't, when I first came up here, it was more difficult for a number of reasons, but one of the mistakes that I was making early on was thinking about what a more traditional sushi menu looks like and then trying to find sustainable replacements for certain species. And that's when I was having more trouble filling a menu. The mistake that I was making was I was doing that rather than just looking at what was abundant and available, because there's so much out there. So once you start doing that, once you start to understand how much sustainable fish exists, it becomes really, really easy to fill a menu. Now I'm having to make decisions every day about what to leave off, what not to order, because there's too much.
So you can find those abundant species from educated by distributors or fishermen?
Yeah. I put most of the responsibility on myself first for learning what's out there, what's in season, learning about different catch methods and farming methods, and then from there seeing what different companies are carrying. So by the time I'm looking at a product list, I don't have to ask questions about every single thing that's there. I can be pretty sure that what I'm ordering is sustainable, and then from there have an educated conversation with the company.
Right. Well, I didn't know that this is so easy. So
yeah, I mean, I think it's easy because Jeff, the one really important point is that he's willing to work with anything that's available. Oftentimes you go into many sushi restaurants and there's pieces that have to be on the menu, right? There's always unagi, there's always bluefin, there's always, you know, certain fish that are hamachi that the reason they're not, those fish in particular, are not sustainable because you need them all the time year round. If you work with the seasons and you're willing to adapt to what's available, then it can become very easy.
Yeah, and I guess it's worth noting that it's easy now because I've been in this business for a while, and I've spent the last several years doing pretty rigorous research on what's available and what's sustainable.
Right. It maybe just sounds like, you know, used to be in terms of wine, the people order Chardonnay or Cabernet Sauvignon. Now, this after all education of wine specialists like you, DJ, I think people started to learn, like, what's this Bulgarian wine and something like that. So is this the beginning of time to educate people in terms of sustainable sushi now, which I think you're leading?
Yeah, one of the things that I guess we'll call it a roadblock when it comes to explaining American seafood or defending American seafood compared with Japanese caught fish is how it's handled, how it's caught, because we have amazing, amazing fish all over the country. What differentiates a lot of it from the Japanese product is how it's caught, how it's handled and stored after it's caught, because the Japanese tradition it goes back so far, and how you handle a fish after it's caught makes a world of difference.
The moment it's caught,
and then the moment it's killed, whether you're bleeding it, whether you're performing ike jime, so that it doesn't go as intensely into rigor mortis. So the reason I brought this up is because we're educating our guests, but there's another facet of this which is really important to the future of American sushi, and that's educating. This sounds kind of arrogant, but educating the seafood companies and fishermen and everybody in that world, because there's not only is there a difference in how and often how people in this country are handling fish, but there are also so many fish that go overlooked because for generations it's been thought of as bait fish. Take something like kohata, for example, which is a shad. In Japan, it's prized for sushi. It's one of the most traditional fish out there. In this country, it never makes it inland because they just use it as bait. They don't know how to transport it properly so that it stays in good condition, which, I mean, all it would take, if anyone is listening who has access to shad, is storing it in ice water and shipping it to 620 East 6th Street.
I love shiny sushi, you know, shiny fish, mackerel. It's almost impossible to find them in this country because they're so wasted.
Yeah. They just end up using them as bait, but they're out there. It's not like they're not out there.
Education.
I think it's educating them about, you know, how to preserve it, but it's also that there can be an industry, right? There can be a market for these fish, and there are people that are willing to perhaps pay a little bit more for well-preserved fish, well-handled fish, over just throw it in a bucket, throw it in, you know, the storage, and then just ship it off, and it gets all busted.
And I think in 10 years, this is going to be old news, because there is a market for it, and it's only growing.
Right.
And that fish is out there.
And a famous story is the toro, the most expensive tuna piece, used to be thrown out.
Yep.
Because it's too fatty for Japanese people. Yep. And they realize, oh, it sells in the market. Mm-hmm. So the same thing happened. Become a diamond.
So even last night, and this is why I mentioned Kohata, the shad. Even last night I was talking to a friend who has done a lot of fishing off the coast of Florida. And I brought it up because it's my favorite fish for sushi. And he was unfamiliar with it. And then when I said its English name, he looked stunned, and he pulled up a picture of it on his phone. And he said, "This?" I was like, "Yeah, that's shad." And he's like, I could go out and throw out a net right now and catch 20 pounds of these in 5 minutes. Anyway, it's out there.
Right. So you made a deal.
Sadly, no.
Right. So that's wonderful. So, and I think most of us are familiar with the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch as the criterion for sustainable fish. But on your website, you put the logo of the James Beard Foundation Smart Catch and Billion Oyster Project. So what are they, and how you are involved in those two organizations' programs?
Yeah, they're great organizations. The Billion Oyster Project, which is one of my favorites, is actually an organization that is looking to reintroduce oysters to the New York Harbor for water filtering purposes. So they actually collect oyster shells from restaurants that have shucked the oyster. So every oyster that you eat, we save the shell, and they come around and they pick them up and they reintroduce them to the polluted waters, and they grow new oysters inside of the shell. So they say that up to 20 new oysters can be grown out of each shell from every oyster that we eat. So it's a great project. They have outposts all over the Brooklyn Navy Yard. I've personally seen a great transformation that
Because oyster shells are a good nest for new oysters.
Yeah,
they like living there, right?
Totally. And it's amazing to see what happens when you start introducing life back to these polluted waters. All of a sudden, now you're seeing seagulls, and you see all of this other life come back simply because of the oyster. And they serve other purposes as well. There's a concept called oyster texture, where they actually build kind of oyster reefs to help prevent storm surge and things like that. So it has a big impact on the environment. James Beard Smart Catch is also a really great organization. They are basically working with chefs to kind of vet their products that they're serving, in order to provide information and certification so that the guest can make informed choices, essentially.
Right.
There are leaders within that organization where, and Jeff can tell you, it's pretty intense scrutiny, if I'm not mistaken, where they go through.
It's just a lot of time spent filling out forms.
On top of selecting a fish. I think the Smart Catch is based on the Monterey Aquarium's Seafood Watch.
Yeah.
And then once you get certification, you can be proud, so customer can feel...
Yeah, they can feel safe.
They use the Seafood Watch as well as a few different other resources. Okay.
Right. And I think it started last year, right, the program? I think
2017 or early 2016. Right. Yeah.
So it's pretty new, but it's a silver lining for the whole industry. Right. Okay. So maybe you can give us some examples of sustainable fish. Abundant.
Oh boy, I would be delighted.
How much time do you have?
We have plenty of time.
Let me take you back to day one. So one of our favorite fish to talk about and to serve as sushi is bluefish. Mm. And I can't tell you how many times I've said, here's some bluefish, and gotten any number of either weird looks or a scoff or really
pure shock.
Anyway, so bluefish is so abundant on the East Coast and has a really rich history and a really rich culinary history in the Northeast. But because it's a little bit more oily, and which means it breaks down a little faster, it's over the years developed an undeserved bad reputation. Because if you're not handling it right, if you're not storing it right, it will, after several days, become an unpleasant fish.
Mm.
So a lot of people who fish and catch it they just throw it back. They would never consider eating it, let alone bringing it home. So when we serve it as sushi, it surprises a lot of people, because if you handle it properly and you're serving it fresh, it's very mild, but it's also fatty and rich. But then because it is a little more oily, like a mackerel, it takes really well to curing the way that you would cure shime saba. Mm. So a little salt, a little vinegar, and all of a sudden you have a much more complex piece that tastes more like traditional sushi, but it's made with bluefish. So that's a good example. Lionfish is one that we serve whenever we can. We had it on most of this past week, coming out of Tarpon Springs, Florida. Lionfish is great sushi. It's white meat fish, so very mild flavor. Everyone likes it. But more importantly, it's a very invasive species, not native to the Gulf, where it's taken over all the way down to the Caribbean. It's native to the Western Pacific, more tropical waters. So down around Florida, they've just taken over for the last couple of decades because the theory is that because they're a popular aquarium fish, somebody at some point just didn't want to kill it. Maybe it got too big for their aquarium, just tossed it in the ocean. Maybe this happened a couple of times. And then, because there's no natural predators for these guys down there, they've just taken over.
Mm.
And they reproduce quickly. They eat a lot. So they're forcing out a lot of native species. So, yeah, it's important to eat them as much as we can all the time. They are a little tougher to come by because they have a bunch of poisonous spines that makes them hard to work with. But once you break through those, you get some really good sushi meat.
And they're harder to catch, right?
So. Oh, because it's spiny or something?
Yeah, so most of them are spear caught. But, yeah, that's two examples. I could talk a lot about other fish that we serve, but
I'm really willing to try that.
Well, I think one other one too that goes with Billion Oyster Project is just oysters and shellfish, which is also typically traditional, but as TJ mentioned before, improve the environment, so they're actually restoring even beyond just sustaining, right?
Right.
So it's always interesting to see someone who is kind of a little standoffish when it comes to eating shellfish as sushi, and when they try it and they're just like, oh wow, this is great. And I think it's just an important one as well.
Right. So
one of my
pretty
favorites is definitely porgy.
Oh, yeah.
Without a doubt. One always excites me to see. You know, traditionally, porgy is looked at as trash fish, or you know, is just thrown overboard and kind of caught by accident. And we happen to love it. And if I'm not mistaken, it is related to Madai. Similar to the sea bream, yeah.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Prize fish in Japan.
Exactly. So when
you're thrown overboard.
When Paul Greenberg was in the restaurant a few months back, he was talking about just essentially rebranding. Paul Greenberg is a seafood writer. He was talking about if you can rebrand a fish, and you can rebrand a fish.
Absolutely.
He was talking about rebranding it as like New York Mod-Eye or East Coast Mod-Eye or something like that.
Yeah, sounds better already.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, but you know, once you actually feed people this fish, they want more.
Mm, right. So, I'm hungry now, hearing it. Economically speaking, how great is the benefit of using sustainable fish?
Don't tell them. Don't. It's not good at all. Don't try it.
I mean, you know that one best.
So. No, yeah. It's good actually, and I said that as a joke. I encourage many more people to try serving sustainable fish because you should be. But man, you know, I've shown past coworkers, like past fellow sushi chefs, invoices of orders that we receive. And they're blown away because of how much money you can save when you're not importing fish from when you're not importing all your fish from Japan. Mm-hmm. You know, there are times you're saving 75%.
Right, of course, because I heard like the Boston tuna is shipped to Tsukiji to raise the price and ship back to New York, and so of course,
and then mackerel. Which I serve as much mackerel as I can because I love it. Mackerel, if you're getting it from Japan, you're paying like $15, $17 a pound for it. When I'm getting it from Massachusetts, it's $1.95.
Wow. Amazing.
And the inverse happens, I think, also with farmed species. We do serve some really heavily vetted farmed species at the restaurant. And those can typically be a little bit pricier because the farms are doing it correctly and they're spending a little bit more money on feed and that kind of thing. Whereas like a you know, high density salmon farm that doesn't really care is always going to be cheaper.
Right. Okay. So a lot of benefits from being sustainable. I think everybody should start.
We agree.
Yep. Okay, so let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about Mayanuki's unique menu, so please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Aki Katema, and my guests today are David Tochano and TJ Provenzano, who are the co-owners of Mayanuki, a charming eight-seat Japanese sushi restaurant in Alphabet City, New York, which opened in May 2017. And also here with us is the executive chef, Jeff Miller. So what kind of menu do you offer at the Mayanuki?
Jeff?
I guess I can talk about that. Yeah.
Seafood, mostly.
Yeah, it's omakase only. So, it's typically in the ballpark of 15 courses. That can vary a little bit. Nigiri heavy, normally 80% just straight nigiri.
Mm. So nigiri versus rolls.
Rolls or sashimi.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to work in some plated dishes as well to keep it interesting for myself and break up the monotony a little bit for the, not monotony, but like, you know, if you're eating 15 pieces of sushi in a row, it can be kind of rhythmic and put you to sleep.
And I think it's only $95, which is
I like that you put only in front of 95. Well, only in this city are people saying only $95 for sushi, and I love that.
But it's becoming $250 normal, and the same 15, pieces, and it's becoming a little, maybe thanks to the economy, but, you know, sushi has to be a little more approachable.
Yeah, I mean, I almost feel like we're reaching, like, the value that people perceive that they need to provide is like you have to be as Japanese as possible. So a lot of the most recent restaurants, that it's like all the wood is from Japan, all of the everything is from Japan. It's like, so you're paying for that, right? And then if you're going into a very large space, the rent is always going to be high in New York. So there's a lot of fixed cost just to begin with trying to operate a restaurant. And I think, you know, we've benefited from the fact that we weren't trying to replicate that. We're trying to do our own thing. And we always... The technology experimentation background that Josh and I had were literally from the reason we did a pop-up was because we knew we couldn't open up a restaurant. So how can we do this as cheaply and quickly and possible just to see if we can be successful? And we've kind of carried that forward. And I think, you know, you see that the opposite end of that on some of the restaurants that are opening up. It's like, how much money can we spend? How big can we make this? How much stuff from Japan?
Mm.
So you have to have a $300 omakase just to walk in the door to pay your bills.
Mm, right. So, again, I think 95, or including all those costs associated with this city.
I think it's important also to be, we're calling $95 approachable, and I think that's fair. But it's so important to be approachable, doing what we're doing something different, so that we can get as many guests in the restaurant as possible. And we're definitely, you know, every day we have to prove ourselves and prove that a sustainable sushi restaurant is a viable thing. And I think long ago we proved that, but sushi doesn't just need to be a special occasion, especially if we're doing sustainable sushi. The way to really make an impact with sustainable seafood is to serve as much of it as possible and slowly change people's tastes and expectations.
Mm, right. Well, speaking of taste, what do you serve traditional sushi? I heard that the menu is innovative too. Like you throw in some Texas flavor. What else do you do for some kind of improvement or innovative creative?
Oh, man. We do incorporate a lot of traditional Japanese technique. The rice, for example, we're using a California grown koshi hikari rice, but I try to make it as Japanese as I can, because that's such a foundational element.
I mean, making by the vinegar, sugar, salt, the kind of combination.
Yeah, I think only in the last couple weeks have I gotten the recipe really just right for the vinegar. So I'm really happy with that. So the foundation is still rooted in Japanese flavor, and then from there I build with, I'm pulling from 11 years of sushi experience and then 32 years of eating experience. I've eaten a lot of American food in my life. But one of the more important words or important concepts and ideas when I'm building a menu is contrast. So a lot of a lot of bright flavors, a lot of herbs, a lot of spices, and then, you know, some more decadent, rich bites here and there. But yeah, you know, I spent a couple years in Houston and ate a lot of Vietnamese food down there, and that's definitely crept into the flavors that I incorporate, which means a lot of lime juice and fish sauce and mint and basil and cilantro and chilies, things like that. You know, I pull from anywhere that I think makes sense and tastes good.
Right. So makes sense. That's the keyword.
Yeah.
Right. Wow. I can't wait to go come and see your sushi. All right. So let's now talk about the beverage program at Mayonaki. So TJ, you're in charge. So what kind of beverage items on the menu?
So we have an all New York State wine list, focusing on kind of the major regions within New York, the North Fork of Long Island, the Finger Lakes, and Hudson Valley, three of my favorites. We carry beer and cider as well from New York State. And then we have sake as well, a lot of sake from Japan, and then sake from Brooklyn as well.
Brooklyn Cura.
Yes, right. Indeed. Yeah. Big fans of Brooklyn Cura. We just did a great pairing event with them the other night. We have a lot in common. As a brand, you know, taking traditional Japanese art, basically, and, you know, focusing it with local ingredients and trying to elevate and expand. As far as the wines go, I've been working in the New York wine industry for a long time. So we focus on smaller batch producers. Typically, I think everything under on our menu is about 5,000 cases or under, which is pretty small as far as wine production goes. It's seasonal as well, so for instance, in summertime right now, I have a little bit heavier North Fork Long Island selection, which I think is just such an easy pairing with local seafood, with seafood in general. You know, obviously it's a beach culture, and there is a lot of organic material in the soil, gives the wines this kind of inherent salinity that I think pairs really well. And, you know, the pairing is a big part of what we're doing. I think it's probably my favorite part of the whole operation is being able to pair these wines and sakes with the fish.
The New York wine, I think, I did some research before. So to me, the taste of Long Island wines and, you know, New York State wine in general tend to be between Europe and California. And then, which means it's not overly sweet, but mineral, lots of minerality. So it's really great with seafood.
Yeah, naturally. Absolutely. And there's, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of differences between the actual regions within New York. So the wines from the North Fork are very different than the wines from the Finger Lakes. The Finger Lakes are fed by these giant glacial lakes. There's like these microclimates, you know, on all five of them. So the wines are a little bit different depending on which lake you're actually, you know, on. And the varietals are different. On Long Island, they tend to focus more on Bordeaux varietals. Whereas upstate in the Finger Lakes, it's a little more Germanic or Alsatian. So a lot of Riesling, a lot of Gewürztraminer, that kind of thing.
They make great ones too.
Absolutely. Yeah, some of the best in the world, I think, really. So it's, you know, we've kind of looked at it as an experimentation. I mean, we've been doing it for about 5 years now. You know, when we were at Brooklyn Oenology, we were pairing with all New York wines, and it just kind of stuck. It was something that, it kind of happened by accident, but when it happened, it just made perfect sense. And, you know, something that we're really proud to represent.
And I think just because TJ has been doing this so long and has relationships with so many local producers, you're getting wines that you don't see in many other restaurants, you know, whether it's Gewürztraminers or orange wines. Like, I actually didn't like white wines before doing my Noki, and TJ introduced me to so many local New York wines where I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. And, we sometimes have to tell customers, like, just give us a chance here and, like, let us try it, you know, take a taste or two. And then after they see how full-bodied a white wine can be, or just, like, how dynamic an orange wine and how well it goes with sushi, you just, people are ordering, like, I need another glass. Do you guys sell this by the bottle?
Yeah.
So it just, it really does go well with.
It does. And we do, you know, some more esoteric selections as well. You know, Dave mentioned orange wines, which has been a, you know, a kind of a surprise hit for us and a great pairing with sushi. So some skin fermented stuff. I personally love cider as well with sushi, and you know, we make some great cider here in New York. We have a lot of apples, so we like to begin our pairing and our meal oftentimes with oysters and apples, which it doesn't really get more New York than that, right? So yeah, right. It's been a lot of fun.
I actually had a conversation recently about orange wine with my Japanese friend. She's a chef. And so she said, well, I can't eat sushi without orange wine because of the umami. Like,
yeah
so extra fermentation flavor.
Yeah, so the funkiness for sure.
So many people have mentioned that, you know, the sushi is great and the wine is great, but when they're put together, they're better than, you know, individually.
Right. Yeah, I'd absolutely multiplied. Agree. Right. Sure. Yeah, and also I did some article about New York State cider, and I was surprised. It doesn't, it's pretty dry, right? Absolutely. More than you think.
Yeah, I mean, that's a stylistic choice that, you know, each cider maker can make, and oftentimes when they make the choice to make a drier style, I think it pairs easier with food, and really kind of takes it to that next level where we're thinking about it as like a well-made wine rather than something you get in a 12-ounce can at the grocery store.
Right. Yeah, and also cider is, in theory, the drier, the higher alcohol, but its highest is like 8% or
something. Yeah, it's about 8%, 9% at the highest, really.
Right.
But oftentimes, that's a great aperitif, you know, having that lower alcohol and, you know, focusing on, you know, the funkiness and the acidity that the apple can bring rather than the sugar, I think makes a great kind of jump off.
Right. Yeah, and this is a slight deviation from the Mayonic thing, but do you work on a rooftop reds? That's another project.
That is another project, absolutely. Yeah, I'm a partner in that vineyard. It is the world's first rooftop vineyard. We are in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, as I mentioned, with the outpost of the Billion Oyster Project, and we grow grapes in container on the rooftop. So it's kind of, you know, taking the next wave of urban agriculture, you know, focusing on, you know, what is possible in the beverage realm rather than just, you know, growing vegetables and things like that. So it's a project that's about 6 years old now.
Wow.
The grapes are doing really well. We're very excited. We just hired a new general manager on the rooftop, Clara Kahn, who's great and really going to take this to the next level. And we're opening a second location here in Bushwick, actually.
Wow. So what kind of grapes can you grow in the city?
So, well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's been an experimentation for sure. We are rooftop reds, so we grow red varietals.
Concord, right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, no, we don't grow Concord on the roof. Concord will grow anywhere, though.
Be like 30% alcohol.
Yeah, right. We could put a Concord grapevine right on this table, and it would grow. But we, on the rooftop, it's about a quarter acre. And we grow all red Bordeaux varietals, so the traditional five blending varietals, Petit Verdot, Malbec, Cab Franc, Cab Sav, and Merlot. And we just had our first harvest last October, so all of that wine is resting at the moment, and it should be available in about a year. And when it is, it will be the world's first wine made from rooftop grapes.
So Bordeaux grapes go well with the sushi, you think? You can say
about Mayonaki. I'm not sure we will. We might, you know, red wines are tough. I think with sushi, oftentimes they can work for sure. This will be a single barrel red varietal wine, and it will also be astronomically more expensive than I think we would like it to be to serve at the restaurant. But we do, you know, we make, as a company, we make other wines as well. So we have a full line of whites and rosés that we make from sourced fruit that we source from farmers. And that has had its presence on our Mayonaki menu.
Interesting. Yeah, one time I had a tuna, which is kind of bloody akami, with gamay, which I also think
gamay is the one that I'd go to for
right.
sure. Yeah,
so
that kind of light, like almost Beaujolais style, like, you know, acidic, bright, fruit forward,
right.
that could work well with a red meat tuna for sure.
So what to pair with sushi?
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So so this is the back to Mayonaki. So what's the biggest challenge in running a sushi restaurant in New York City?
Oh, the biggest. There's so many.
Well, from our perspective, I think one, like I mentioned before, was, you know, we were lucky to have met TJ from the beginning. But I think, you know, without finding TJ, just with his experience helping to run the restaurant, and then, as I mentioned before, finding a chef that cares about, in our case, sustainability when it comes to sushi. You know, we talk to a lot of chefs, and they just kind of look at us with glassed over eyes, like, what are you talking about? Why would you not serve bluefin tuna, or, you know, all of these things? But from the operational day-to-day, I'll let these guys answer. But, yeah, from our perspective, that's that. And then, you know, everybody loves the Department of Health, obviously.
yeah, they're great.
Give them a shout-out.
I guess I'll agree with that. I don't know. It's not that hard.
I mean, so I guess maybe from another aspect would be, there's just so much competition, right? So, I mean, just having people to know that you exist, and there's so many restaurants that are trying to get on a handful of publications or, you know, outreach, and to reach enough people to, you know, once people come into the restaurant, they love the experience, and, you know, they often come back. They'll come back with another six people because of how, you know, intimate the restaurant is. But I would say that's probably the biggest challenge for us, is like exposure.
There's plenty of competition, I guess, but we're doing something so different that we're really, there's not another restaurant like us in New York. So it's easy to make an impact doing that, because there's not really a reference point for what we're doing other than traditional sushi. So yeah, we definitely stand out.
And dietary restrictions. It's always a challenge.
No, man, it's an opportunity.
It's an opportunity for sure. But, you know, getting people kind of out of their comfort zone of tuna salmon yellowtail, you know, that sometimes can be a challenge to convince people that, you know, if they will try some of these things that we've prepared, that it's going to be just as enjoyable.
Hey, but props to our guests who have... So many people have come in and seemed uncomfortable at first, but they power through.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, we've had a collection of just amazing people come into the restaurant.
Well, that's the nature of omakase, right? Because you are trusted. And omakase means leave it to you. So you can serve the sustainable, unknown fish to the customers.
Yeah, I feel kind of, you know, I'm not from New York, and I feel kind of spoiled, like the cross section of people who I get to see in the city are so fantastic, because I mean, the people who are going to go to a sustainable omakase restaurant tend to be all right people.
So, yeah. Right, but who are your customers then?
Oh man,
runs a gamut. I mean, we have pretty wide ranging demographics. You know, from, you know, college students that are studying environmental studies to, you know, the Wall Street types. I mean, we get it everywhere in between.
And yeah, a lot of young East Village crowd. We've been developing some awesome regulars. One couple who has been in, I think, 36 or 37 times since we opened. A lot of creative, artistic-minded people.
Yep, absolutely.
Maybe that's your ambience, like energy. The restaurant might be inviting those people too.
Yeah, for sure. Also, there's this type of person doesn't really exist outside of New York or maybe LA, but people who are just going to every omakase restaurant. It's like, this is the new one. They got to check it off their list and move on to the next one.
But, you know, as these guys said, we get a lot of return guests. You know, once they come, you know, I think that has a lot to do with the ambiance, like you said, but also the fact that Jeff's menu is constantly changing and evolving. They know that every time they come back, there's going to be some sort of surprise.
Right. Well, that's working, right? The sustainable unknown fish. Inviting repeat customers, that's really working. So
definitely.
Yeah. Right. Actually, I think you just brought up, this is going back to a previous question, the hardest part for me about running this restaurant is a menu that changes every day.
Yeah.
When you decide to be a sustainable restaurant, you're to a certain extent throwing yourself on the mercy of the seasons and what's available and what fishermen are catching, which from one day to the next it changes. So that means I've got to be on my toes all the time.
Right.
It's fun. It's fun most of the time.
Mm. Well, that's the nature of sushi tradition. So
yeah,
are the chef. Right. Okay. So what's your plan for the future?
Serve sushi to people.
Absolutely.
And delicious wines. Yeah, I mean, honestly, right now, I think we're just humbled that we were able to survive for a year in our brick and mortar, and to just continue that for as long as the city will allow us to do that. I think the ultimate goal is to kind of show other restaurants that we... all sushi restaurants could be sustainable. Mm. There are definitely some differences to approach that you need to do, but we can have an impact that will have... a very material impact on the environment. The oceans are, I think, a lot more important than people understand. And, being able to have an impact just from the each bite that you take, if we can just impart that idea to folks, I think, and, if people are going to other restaurants and talking with the sushi chefs there and asking them questions about sustainability, I think, that to me at least would be a goal.
Mm, right. It's amazing. So I really think you guys are doing amazing things. So
thank you. See what you say after you eat that.
Okay. I'll see you soon. So for listeners, what's your web address and social addresses?
www.myanoki.com.
Mm-hmm. It's
M-A-Y-A-N-O-K-I. And then we're on Instagram for the most part. And TJ's cell phone number is no.
Yeah. It's out there.
And then we're at 620 East 6th Street between Avenues B and C. So if you're in the neighborhood, swing on by, say hello.
Yeah, that's great. All right. So so David, TJ, Jeff, thank you for coming.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikukatema.com. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So our engineer is David Tadashore, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah. And my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.